Hi, I'm Andrew Searles. This is number 0314 of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0314. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, remembering actress Yvonne Craig, best known for her role as Batgirl on the hit 60s TV series Batman. Playing Batgirl was a blast for her, as it was for the guest stars who played villains.
Guest stars were just dying to do that show because it was so far out for its time and it was so different from anything that they would ever have normally done. So it was just, I tell you, it was the best experience I've ever had in a working situation. It was just terrific.
Disney animator Tom Sito, author of Moving Innovation, A History of Computer Animation. Animation is something he's always wanted to do from very early in life.
When I graduated high school, they had a big show at Lincoln Center in New York on the 50th anniversary of the Walt Disney Studio. And all these guys came out from the West Coast and they brought the work reels of the new, their upcoming movie, Robin Hood. And it was the first time I saw rough animation, you know, animation that wasn't colored. It was just the pencil drawings. So it's sort of like raw thought on paper. And I was just so charmed by that. I was like, wow, you know, I want to do that. You know, people draw and the characters come to life and they run around on the screen. And like, what a great thing.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff. And of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0314 was comedian Andrew Searles. And by the way, he is headlining at Montreal's Comedy Works September 24th through to the 26th. You can check him out by going to his website, which is andrewsearles.com. And you'll find his website on the What's On page for this show, which he just mentioned, number 0314. Thank you very much, Andrew, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? And we start off with the Darwin File, because, as you know, the tree of life is often self-pruning. A French couple fell to their death while having sex at a historic castle. The unidentified couple in their 30s apparently fell from about 40 feet into a moat around the wall surrounding the castle of the Vauban Fort on the island of Chaussee Archipelago in the English Channel. The naked bodies of a man and woman who were both born in 1984 were found on Thursday morning. Their belongings were reportedly found above at the castle. The man was found in a dried-out part of the moat, while the body of the woman was found immersed in shallow water. Police in the area told local media that it was possible the pair were engaged in, quote, lovemaking that could have gone wrong. Well, you figure. The couple were both from the Normandy region of France. The fort, by the way, was built on the orders of Napoleon III back in 1859 and later held 300 German and Austrian prisoners of war during the First World War. Well, that's going out with a bang and a thud, isn't it? Yeah. And we have yet another item here that has thinned out the herd. When two men who had been drinking in the apartment of 30-year-old Brandon Thomas in Conyers, Georgia, on July 23rd wanted to leave, Brandon objected. "If y'all are gonna drink my alcohol, y'all are gonna play my game," he said, announcing that his game was Russian roulette. Minutes later, after spinning the revolver's cylinder, Brandon lost the game. There you go. And in a somewhat similar vein, the estate of Dr. Rajan Verma filed a lawsuit in July against the Trauf Music Hall in Buffalo, New York, after Dr. Verma fell to his death following a concert when he lost his balance sliding down the banister. The estate claims that there must have been a sticky substance on the railing. The estate's lawyers said that since alcohol was served at the concert, the promoters should have known to take extra safety precautions for banister riders. Really? Because, you know, most concert-goers aren't usually 6 years old, but I digress. Clearly, you know, when it comes to America's litigious society, they are on a slippery slope. Yes. Moving right along, in Scotland, I'm sure many of you have texted and had the experience of either receiving or sending an inadvertent message due to autocorrect. Well, here's just the latest example of that. A Scottish mom requested for a wee blonde girl atop her daughter's birthday cake, and that led to an unusual cake topper when autocorrect changed blonde to blind. Lanarkshire resident Emily Seggy shared a picture on Twitter of her sister's birthday cake, which was topped with a wee blind girl as a result of her mother's autocorrect mishap while sending a text message to the baker. The girl atop the cake has dark hair instead of the intended blonde, and her eyes are closed while she holds a toothpick as a cane. Said Emily, the text message must have autocorrected to blind girl, and when my mom went to collect it, she was wondering why it wasn't blonde. They then realized what had happened after checking the text and decided to leave it because it was funny. Hope no one is offended. Well, there have been a lot worse autocorrections out there than that one, so if someone's offended by that, well, get a life. Moving right along, authorities in Kentucky say they arrested a man accused of drunkenly trying to dig up his father's grave to help the nearly 40-year dead man get to heaven. 44-year-old Michael May, whose father Odell died in 1978, was arrested one recent night on charges of violating a grave, possession of marijuana, and public intoxication. May, who had allegedly been drinking alcohol and smoking marijuana, was discovered digging up a plot at the Pilot Baptist Church in rural Lincoln County by a constable whose suspicions were piqued when he saw May's car. Said Constable Delbert Mitchell, "I went back and hollered for him to step back into the light, and he told me to step back out into the dark. That's when I went and got my flashlight. He started hollering out Bible verses at me. He told me he was trying to dig his dad up so that his dad could go to heaven." May told police he does not believe he was doing anything wrong by trying to dig up his father's grave. "I see the truth. He needs to be on the ground, not under it," May said. Police asked May if he planned on making a second attempt to exhume his father's remains. "It's a possibility. If the truth doesn't come out and nobody sees the truth, yeah, I'll do it again," he said. So, I guess it's fair to say that Michael will be locked up for a while. Now, the question is, where? I mean, there are a couple of different kinds of facilities that he might be primed for. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first segment here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, once again, during a police raid of a suspected drug house, this time in Wood River, Illinois, in July, with cops swarming the home and yard, confiscating evidence and arresting occupants, officers had to stop briefly from time to time to answer the front door. And when I say time to time, 10 times at least during a 90-minute period, as the dealer's regular and obviously oblivious customers continually arrived to buy more heroin. Now, if that story doesn't illustrate the old anti-drug commercials of this is your mind on drugs, then nothing will. As the last line of those ads used to say, any questions? Okay. On to our first segment on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. This past week, Hollywood lost another icon. This time, it was a woman whom both young boys and young girls idolized. Actress Yvonne Craig came into this world with a desire to be a prima ballerina. But the lasting image we have of this talented and athletic actress was as Batgirl on the hit 1960s series Batman. Yvonne Craig died at the age of 78 on August 17th at her California home after losing a two-year battle with breast cancer. We had a chance to talk to Yvonne back in March of 2001. At the time, she was promoting her memoir entitled From Ballet to the Batcave and Beyond. And as you'll hear in the first part of our two-segment remembrance of Yvonne, she was just a delight to talk to, a great storyteller, and very easygoing. I started off by asking her at the time why she felt it was right, at that time, to put out her book.
You know, I had sort of not wanted to do it, and one of the writers from Batman, Stanley Ralph Ross, for years had been saying to me, you have such funny stories, you should write it. And of course, he tried to make everybody a writer. I mean, he loved his work, and he tried to make everybody a writer. And he said to me, you know, if you ever decide to write a book, I'll help you. So I had been doing some conventions, and my sister said to me, you know what, every time you go to a convention, people ask you essentially the same questions, and you tell them the same stories, and, you know, you should put it between covers. So I thought, well, maybe I will. So I did. And when I first started, it seemed very easy. So I wrote about five chapters, and then rested on my laurels for 9 months because it seemed like, oh, well, I could get this done in 3 weeks. And then I came back to it, and the funny thing is that I don't type, so I type like a chimpanzee. And I was making these stories really short because I didn't want to have to embellish them because that meant hunting for more letters. And finally, I got a voice-activated a voice recognition program for my computer. And because I'm a talker, I talked and talked and talked and talked, and it typed. And it was like a miracle. And so so then I started writing the book, and I got really interested in it, and it became this book that just went on and on and on.
You mentioned that you go to the conventions, and people seem to ask you the same questions. What's the most common question that you get when people meet you at conventions?
Oh, well, let's see. It depends on what the tone of the convention is, but a lot of people want to know what it was like working with Elvis. I mean, that was a major thing. I did two movies with Elvis, and they want to know that. They want to know what it was like being green, because I was the green lady in a Star Trek episode in the last season of Star Trek. And of course, they all are interested in, you know, how did you get the job in Batman, and what was it like working on Batman, and who's your favorite villain, and stuff like that.
Well, the title of the book is called From Ballet to the Batcave and Beyond, and clearly you had to be a very physical person to play the role of Batgirl. Did you ever anticipate, you know, especially someone who's classically trained as you were to do ballet, that you'd be in a role like this, playing Batgirl?
No, I never dreamed I would, and I just loved it. I mean, I had been looking for a series because no matter how much episodic TV you do, and I did a tremendous amount of episodic TV, nobody ever connects a name with a face. You know, they say, oh, that's, well, you see her all the time. I don't know who she is, but she works a lot. And so I really was looking for a series to do. And when my agent, and I had done four pilots or five pilots prior to getting the call, you know, asking me if I would like to do a character that they were thinking of incorporating into the Batman series. And so I was really excited to be thought of, you know, for that role. And at the time that they were trying to incorporate this female character in it, it was a big hit. I mean, Batman was already a success, so it wasn't like, oh, we're going to have to shoot this pilot and then find out if anybody's interested and all of that. So I was very happy to join the group.
Now, you had done a lot of, as you said, episodic television and
yeah.
A lot of guest shots here and there. I remember seeing episodes of you already brought up Star Trek. I remember you on a couple episodes of The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Right.
And I'm just wondering, at that time, was that still under the studio system?
No, it never did fall under the studio system. I came in at the tail end of live television, thank goodness, because that was a scary prospect. And at the beginning of filmed television, we shot with three cameras. The studio system was almost phased out by the time I got in. I was offered a contract at 20th Century Fox because I did a lot of work at Fox, but that was just before they were about to go under, and I kind of saw the writing on the wall and said to my agent, you know, I don't want to be at Fox. It looks to me like they're not going to last another year. This was right after Cleopatra. And so I kind of liked freelancing, and I'm glad I did, because you had a better chance. I mean, it was a little dicier as far as income was concerned, but you certainly had more mastery over your own destiny.
Now, just around the time you got to play the role, and I'm sure you hear this from a lot of guys, just around the time that you started to play the role on Batman, was just a little before puberty for me, and along comes this girl in a very tight outfit riding a motorcycle. Do you hear these stories a lot?
I hear these stories a lot, and it's funny because the age of the child goes anywhere from 5 when you think, my word, he peaked early, to somebody who's about 12 years old, you know, who was 12 years old when it happened. And I can understand that. I was, when their hormones shot up, I was the first person they saw in a very tight costume, and they decided that maybe girls weren't so bad after all.
What was it like for you when you first saw that costume? Was it difficult to get into?
Oh, no. That was a really, really comfortable costume. It was made of a stretch fabric, and it had a zipper all the way up the back. And so it was easy in and out. It was very comfortable. They had cut the eye holes in my mask quite large, so I didn't have any vision problems in it. And it was just easy to move around in.
When you came on the set, as you said, it was an established show. It's been on for several years. And you're basically, as far as the regular character is concerned, the only female. Was it like going into an old boys' club at the time?
No, it really wasn't. And when I look back on it, I'm really amazed at how nice they were to me, because, I mean, they were introducing a character, which was really two characters. I mean, it was Barbara Gordon, who was going to take up screen time, and it was Batgirl, who was going to take up more screen time. And with as many established characters as there were with the alter egos of both Adam and Batman and Robin, mm-hmm. plus Commissioner Gordon and the Chief of, you know, and Alfred, and then the guest stars, you would have thought that they would have resented it simply because it was taking up film time that could easily have been allocated to them. And they didn't at all. They were just, everybody was really nice. It's probably the happiest set I've ever worked on. It remained that way for the 26 episodes that I was on it. The cast and crew got along very well, and they worked well together. And of course, all of the guest stars were just dying to do that show because it was so far out for its time, and it was so different from anything that they would ever have normally done. So it was just, I tell you, it was the best experience I've ever had in a working situation. It was just terrific.
You rode the bike. Did you do all of your own stunts?
Yeah, I did. I did. In the beginning, they didn't want me to, and they had hired a stunt girl, and then thank goodness they were afraid I would be injured. And I just kept saying, you know, I can understand why you wouldn't want guys to do this, because people are trying to throw punches at them, but I'm just escaping from people's grasp, and I don't know why I can't do my own stuff. And so they hired a stunt girl, and she lasted, I guess, about 2 episodes, or maybe not even that. And number one, she didn't ride the bike. So I had to do the bike riding anyway. And number two, she got a job doubling Julie Andrews in Darling Lily. And so we lost her. And so then it was mine.
Now, when you were going out on the street at that time, I mean, I'm sure people still talk about being back, but what was it like, you know, joining a hit show? How did that change your life at that point?
You know, when we would on on weekends do personal appearance tours because, of course, we were trying to glean an audience that was broader in scope. And so I used to do PA tours, and they had originally said to me, we will hire bodyguards for you. And I said, I don't think you're going to need them. And they said, oh, yes, Adam and Bert had their clothes ripped off. And I said, well, think about it. First of all, because of my demeanor, I don't think anybody would dare to rip my clothes off. I mean, I just don't think that's a possibility. But I said, secondly, most people are brought up that they're not supposed to be pawing at women, and so they would not do that. And it turned out I was right. I mean, nobody ever bothered me. They were always very polite. They were all, you know, they always kept their distance. They weren't ripping at my clothes, but I do understand that they did so with Adam and Bert. They were tearing at their capes and just being, you know, obnoxious.
Yeah. Plus, you were the commissioner's daughter. Who would do that?
Well, yeah, and besides, I don't think women were treated that way in those days. Now, thanks to Madonna, I guess everything's up for grabs.
Literally, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
That was part of an interview I did with Yvonne Craig back in March of 2001. TV's former Batgirl was promoting her book, From Ballet to the Batcave and Beyond. It was part of an hour-long conversation that we had. We have a little more to share with you from Yvonne from 2001 and that visit that we had together. That's coming up after the break here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the common folk. It all comes to you here on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Welcome back to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, as we take a little more time to remember the late actress Yvonne Craig, TV's Batgirl, who died at the age of 78 just last week. As I mentioned, this was from a conversation with the dancer-turned-actress that we had back in 2001 when she was promoting her book, From Ballet to the Batcave and Beyond. One of the more bizarre events in her life was the infatuation that Howard Hughes seemed to have for her. I got her to share that story.
Well, there's a whole chapter in the book about my my being under contract to Howard Hughes, and it is subtitled, Give Me Back My Guinea Pig. I don't know how he saw me or where he saw me, but apparently he saw me when I first came to town. Contacted the man who had become my manager and said that he was getting back into show business because he had been out of the business actually of producing and doing that for I don't know how long, and that he had the rights to a book, and I think it was called Pale Moon, and he was having a script written, and he wanted me for the leading lady, and he would like to put me under contract to him while the script was being prepared. So I met the writer, and it all seemed on the up and up, and he had me under exclusive contract, and it was okay. And then strange things began to happen, and then stranger things began to happen, and then one day, the straw that broke the camel's back was that I went home to my apartment and found that there was nothing in it. I mean, my clothes were gone, my canned goods were gone, my dog was missing, and my guinea pig was gone. And just before I was ready to call the police, his secretary came in and said, oh, I'm so sorry that you arrived here before I did. She said, Mr. Hughes decided that this is not a safe place for you to live. And so he has moved you out and all of your belongings and into the Chateau Marmont. Now, that was before the Chateau Marmont became, you know, the den of iniquity where John Belushi overdosed.
Right.
But anyway, so he moved me to the Chateau Marmont, and, of course, they would not permit pets. So my dog went to a vet and was boarded there, and my guinea pig went who knew where. And so I was there probably 10 days, maybe a little longer, but I would think no more than about 10 days, and tried to make a phone call out. And the woman downstairs said to me, I'm sorry, but you're not allowed to make a phone call out. And I said, no, I'm sorry. I think you probably mean I'm not allowed to make long-distance calls, and that I can understand. I can certainly make phone calls. And she said, why don't you come downstairs? And so I went downstairs, and there she sat, and she said, I could lose my job for telling you this, but I think you need to know that Mr. Hughes has requested that no phone calls go in or out.
Why?
Who knows? I mean, who knows? I never saw the man. I never met him. They used to call me up and say, Mr. Hughes would like to see you. And then I would go to the office where they said he was going to be, and then I would sit and wait and sit and wait and sit and wait, and he never showed up, and then it would get dark, and they would say, well, Mr. Hughes never sees anybody when it's dark, and then I would go home. And now, looking back on it, I mean, with the stuff that's come out about him, I have a feeling, and this is so creepy, but I have a feeling that he saw me, even though I didn't see him.
That's a movie plot all on its own.
Ew, it's just really good. But anyway, so when she told me this, I said, okay, thank you very much. And I went down to the corner and made a phone call and picked up a newspaper. And the next day went out and rented another apartment and just said to my manager, oh, look, tell Mr. Hughes when he has a script ready for me to do, I'm happy to read it, but I do not want to be under contract to him, and I don't want to be just sitting around waiting for work. And so when he has it, get back to me.
Now, that's when you first came to town. Came to town from where?
Oh, well, I was with the reason it's called From Ballet to the Batcave and Beyond was because I was with a ballet russe de Monte Carlo back when ice covered the earth. And I was a soloist with that company, and so I had been, we were stationed in New York, and then we would tour the United States and parts of Canada, and I guess we went to Puerto Rico one time, but essentially we toured the United States, and I came out to Los Angeles because I was getting ready to go with a ballet company in Europe, and came to Los Angeles to study for the summer. And just inadvertently got into the movies. I mean, I was seen by somebody who said, you know, are you an actress? And before I could say no, the man I was with said, she is, and I'm her manager. And I became an instant actress. But things like that happened in those days. I guess it still happens. I mean, they say, oh, my gosh, you're Naomi Campbell, and I'll bet you can act.
Right. Did you, when you were growing up, was it your goal to be an actress, or did you just want to be a prima ballerina?
It was my goal to be a prima ballerina.
Mm.
Yes, from the time I was 10 years old, that was my goal. And I just inadvertently got into acting and realized that I really, really liked it. But I think at the time that I began acting, if somebody had said to me, you will never dance again, I would have gone home and taken gun to temple. If somebody had said to me in the beginning, you will never be allowed to act again, I'd have said, okay. Because it wasn't this burning desire. Now, as I began to do it, I realized that I really liked it, and that it was far more interesting because you're using all of you, including voice, as opposed to just, you know, using technique and your body for dancing. But there is a crossover there because even when you're dancing and you're not, I mean, obviously, you're not talking. you still have to develop a character. I mean, you are still developing a character and playing another person.
Yeah. Well, judging by the picture on the cover of your book, one of the things I'm sure that ballet was able to teach you for roles like Batgirl is that, you know, you could kick a basketball player in the head without leaving the ground. But what else? What else could you? What else did your ballet training do to help you in your roles?
I tell you what it did. A ballet training is excellent for. I've never known a ballet dancer ever to be late. They are never late. You are disciplined. You are there when the class starts, or you don't get to take it. It just is very good training for discipline, and I think that that's a good thing.
Would you consider yourself, at least at the time, to be? I mean, because we talk to you now, you're fun, you're jovial. Would you consider yourself a serious person when you were ballet dancing?
You know, yes. I think all ballet dancers have that little, I am a little serious rat look, you know, because we all pull our hair back, or at least then we did. We all skinned our hair back and looked very intense. But you are intense because it's interesting with ballet. With ballet in particular, there is only one right way. I mean, there is only one first, second, third, fourth, and fifth position, and if you're not in it, you're wrong. And so you can take comfort in knowing that there is definitely a standard, and if you don't meet that standard, you're incorrect. It's you know, that's the good part, the good part about it. It's very wearing on body parts. I danced, but I didn't continue to dance professionally, as some of my ex-roommates did, and they all are on their second set of hips. I mean, I have the original ones I was born with, but they are into hip replacement.
You did get to dance in Like Flint.
Yes, I did. When I look back on it, I got to do a lot of dancing, but the ballet dancing that I got to do was definitely in Like Flint. Yeah, and that was wonderful. It was, now, unfortunately, I mean, I played a Russian ballerina, but unfortunately, it was shot from such a distance that when you saw the film, it could have been anybody. I knew it was I, but nobody else would have known except, you know, maybe my family because they knew how I moved. But it looked like it was shot on stage 10 from stage 12.
Now, again, with the title of the book, From Ballet to Batcave and Beyond, I'm sure a lot of people out there are wondering, what was Beyond? Because
it's interesting, because Beyond was, when I first started that book, I was going to write From Ballet to the Batcave, and then Beyond was going to be all of the things that I did afterwards, which was a lot. I've done a tremendous amount of travel. And it has been adventure travel, mostly. I mean, I've gone to Africa probably 6 times on safari, and I've been to the Galapagos and broke my foot in a lava tube in the Galapagos, and have been whitewater rafting in Ecuador and just doing all kinds of fun things. And so I thought that was going to be it, and then I realized as I was going on that really had no place in that book, and the Beyond was just the work that I did after Batman. Some of it is prior to Batman, but it's just other work that I did and other fun stories about people that I worked with. So I cover a lot of ground in it. I had done 4 Dobie Gillises, and I had worked with Francis X. Bushman, which makes me sound like I must be as old as Anime Wong or something. But anyway. and I did, you know, a lot of episodic TV, so I covered a lot of that. And there's a chapter on Bill Bixby, because I did all of his shows with the exception of The Hulk, and I dated him. And then Vince Edwards, because I did, you know, worked with him and dated him. And just a lot of, you know, fun, funny stories. And so that was what the Beyond was. And actually, the Star Trek that I did was Beyond Batman. I did it the year after I did Batman.
We mentioned the effect that you had on young boys when you were Batgirl.
Yes.
Would you say, did you have the same effect? Were you a role model for young girls?
You know, it's interesting because when they hired me to do that, they said, we're interested in, they didn't do demographic studies in those days, but they said, we're interested in broadening our audience base and hoping to get over 40s males and prepubescent females. And I thought, well, I can understand that they'll get over 40s males because the costume was spray on, but I thought, I don't think little girls are going to like me. I think they're going to be, you know, either in love with Adam and jealous, or interested in Burt Ward and wondering why I'm on the screen taking up time. And as I have over the years gone to conventions and things like that, or just been out and have had people recognize me, women say, oh, you were my first role model. I mean, I was so thrilled to know that girls could kick butt just as well as or better than boys. And so it's a great feeling, and I really like to hear that from women because, I mean, we knew why little boys watched that. but I wasn't sure we were ever getting the young female audience, and I guess we did.
Do you still act today?
Am I active today?
As an actress?
No. Haven't acted, probably not since, well, I haven't acted, actually, since 76. I mean, we've been on you know, reunion shows and talk shows and all of that together, but no, I haven't acted since about 76. I went into the real estate business and had my own real estate business for a long time, and when I got out of that, my sister and I produced prepaid phone cards, and actually, it was interesting because we produced the Clueless prepaid phone card with Alicia Silverstone on the front of it.
Hmm. Do you miss acting?
Do I, you know, I miss the doing of it because it's always exciting to rehearse and kind of fill out a character and find something new to do with it. But I don't miss, and I hope I can say this on radio, but I don't miss the bullshit of the business.
Well, I
probably got bleeped,
no,
right?
No, I'm leaving it in. I'm looking at the still photo, which is a current photo, and you still got it, girl.
Thank you.
Just want to say that. It's been a pleasure talking to you this evening.
That was just a small part of a longer conversation that I had with actress Yvonne Craig. And yes, I was gushing there a bit because she still had it. She was a beautiful person both inside and out. An absolute joy to talk with, who seemed to enjoy the twists and turns that life put in front of her. Her book was From Ballet to the Batcave and Beyond. And her life was a little like her famous role on TV, a fun ride. Yvonne passed away at her home on August 17th at the age of 78, after a 2-year battle with breast cancer. By the way, you can hear the full hour-long interview with Yvonne Craig on my website at thestufffile.com. Just click on Celebrity Audio Files and you'll find the interview and also interviews with many other stars. They're all listed in alphabetical order, and you can play them right off the page. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holden.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Remember the story about the boy who cried wolf? It's about sounding a false alarm so often that people stop listening even when there's a real danger. We got a modern-day twist on that story from a man who heard a report about our wacky warning label contest and sent us a note. He's a hunter and owns many types of guns. All of them came with a warning to wear ear protection, even the guns that weren't loud. Over the years, he started ignoring the warnings because the guns were so quiet. Then, one day, a new gun with the same warning fired a shot so loud that it still causes ringing in his ears today. Let's be fair, a warning that advises us to use ear protection when firing a loud gun is certainly not wacky. However, this man's experience provides a lesson. The lawsuit problem that has led to warnings on virtually everything often makes us deaf to the warnings that are really needed. It's one more example of how lawsuit abuse is jeopardizing public safety in America today. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
This is your safe haven from the hard news of the day. The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for your happy place.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to renowned Disney animator Tom Sito. He's got a book out called Moving Innovation, A History of Computer Animation. And we do indeed have, later on in the program, as we always do, an idiot of the day. But right here, right now, a few more Stuff File stories to share with you on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Firefighters were called to a home in Cape Coral, Florida, when lightning struck a boat in the backyard, setting it on fire. It was totally destroyed. We thought it was our neighbor's boat, but it was not. It was our boat, said Marie Kratke. She says she tried long ago to get her husband to get rid of it, but he never did. It's not a loss at all, she said. It's a blessing. 5 hours later, lightning struck again, because, as you know, the Lord works in mysterious ways, setting the house on fire. So this time, firefighters had to go inside. They discovered an alleged marijuana grow operation and called the police. Police got a search warrant and subsequently arrested 65-year-old Yaroslav Kratke on charges of production, cultivation of marijuana within 1,000 feet of a school or church, and possession of marijuana over 20 grams. Kratke says he is innocent, saying what police confiscated was ragweed, not pot. I'm a pack rat. You know I got things. I'm a junk man. Police say they have no doubt what they confiscated was marijuana, and Kratke allegedly commented, I don't know why they're making such a big deal about marijuana. It's getting legal everywhere. Yeah, at this point, I'm reminded of the words of Mark Twain. The trouble ain't that there is too many fools, but that the lightning ain't distributed right. Can't really sum that up better than that, can I? Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, he neutralized a major threat. An Oklahoma man who was protecting a gun store that banned Muslims accidentally shot himself. The gun-toting goon was a group of self-proclaimed patriots, and I'm doing air quotes when I say patriots, standing guard outside the Save Yourself Survival and Tactical Gear store, which made national headlines last week by posting a sign declaring it a Muslim-free establishment. After inevitable uproar, the store's supporters took arms and stood outside to prevent a potential attack. But one man at Save Yourself could not save himself from himself. His Colt 45 revolver fell out of his holster and discharged, hitting him in the wrist. The man, who hasn't been identified, did not suffer a life-threatening injury, police said. The local sheriff said he was not surprised by the shooting because many of the defenders outside Save Yourself didn't seem equipped for their equipment. I saw several of those gentlemen out there yesterday, Muskegee County Sheriff Charles Pearson said. The way they were holding their weapons with their fingers on the triggers, you could tell a couple of these gentlemen had no idea about weapon safety. It's like the Clampets had come to town. That's his actual quote. The store's co-owner, Chad Neal, posted an anti-Islamic sign after a Muslim man fatally shot four Marines at military centers in Chattanooga, Tennessee last month. He told the Daily News business had actually increased since he banned Muslims, and customers have told him how they now feel safer in the store. Wow. They feel safer in the store. What kind of gene pool is in this town anyway? In any case, this story is just a classic case of loaded karma. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our final guest on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? We've had Tom Seto on the show before. He's an animator who's worked on such classics as The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, The Lion King, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and more. We had him on the show 4 years ago to talk about a couple of his books, Drawing the Line, The Untold Story of the Animation Unions from Bosco to Bart Simpson, and Timing for Animation. Well, this time he's back to talk about another book he's written. It's actually one he wrote a little while ago. It's now coming out in paperback. It's entitled Moving Innovation, A History of Computer Animation. He's also featured in a PBS bio on Walt Disney that airs on September 14th. Plus, he has a great blog on historical facts. Tom's a very, very busy guy, so I'm glad he found some time to join us via Skype from California to talk. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us once again.
All right.
So the book, which, as I just mentioned, is also now coming out in paperback, is... It's called Moving Innovation, A History of Computer Animation. Now, you have been in animation for quite some time now, so you kind of predate computer animation, I'm assuming, correct?
Yes. Yeah. When I got started in the animation business, a lot of the Golden Age artists who did Snow White and Pinocchio from the classic 1940s era were still active. You know, they were just about retiring. But technologically speaking, the most advanced thing we had in the office was an electric pencil sharpener.
So you learned from the masters, and you learned, shall we say, for lack of a better term, the old-fashioned way. You now work in a situation where computers have taken over to a certain degree from the actual pen. Has it improved the way things are done, in your estimation, as an artisan?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We're still sort of gauging the effects of it all, because it hasn't, you know. Like, you know, sort of like the people who bemoaned the passing of silent film said that some of the pathos or some of the pantomime had disappeared. I think the same way with computer graphics, you know, the color and the cinematography and the camera work is much more sophisticated than it was years ago, but we might be losing some of that personal touch of hand drawn that used to appeal to people.
But I'm also assuming that it is it allows the creative mind of the artist to fulfill his or her dreams in a much easier way, as opposed to being frustrated by some sort of limitations.
Yes, that's true. You know, when we did Little Mermaid, which was like one of the last traditionally painted Disney films, just because of budgetary reasons, when you had to pick colors for Ariel, let's say, you had a set of daytime colors, a set of nighttime colors, and then maybe one section, like when Ursula's putting the spell on her and she's in the glow of the firelight. A little different, but that's it. You know, that's no other change. And when things went digital, you could now basically art direct every single cut. You know, in 1550 cuts in a traditional, you know, a standard, you know, length film.
I know I asked you this question the last time we spoke when we talked about your previous two books, but in writing this book, Moving Innovation, who were your prime target audience for this? Was it the person who was a fan of how animation is done, or the person who wanted to become an animator themselves, or both?
I think I'm sort of talking to more of a general public, because a lot of books that had been written up to the point on computer graphics are sort of preaching to the choir, you know, like it's sort of inward turning, and it tended to be very tech oriented. You know, so a lot of the stuff you'd read, it'd be like, you know, well, we had a 356K Z buffer and we needed to improve the anti-aliasing, so we went to a general, you know, and it's like, I don't know what they're talking about, you know. It's like, and it's all, you know, archaic now anyway. And I was fascinated about the people who created this thing, and where did they come from? You know, there was no master plan for Hollywood to go digital. You know, there was no, you know, John Kennedy going, you know, our goal in 10 years is to create a computer animated cartoon. We do this not because it is easy, but because it is hard. You know, it's like nothing like that happened. It was all done guerrilla. You know, like it was all done people under the table, on their own time. You know, they walked away from tenured professorships and they quit jobs just so that they could feed this passion or this dream, collective dream they had to try to make computers create art, which in the 60s was like crazy. You know, I mean, when you think of what people thought of computers in the 60s, they were like these like James Bond death machines, you know, these devices to track nukes. So the idea that you would make warm, fuzzy Disney characters with them just seemed like the height of insanity.
How long before you got into animation did you want to be an animator?
I think I always wanted to. Even when I was in school, you know, as soon as I learned that you could actually like make a living at this, you know, I remember my when I graduated high school in 1973, they had a big show at Lincoln Center in New York on the 50th anniversary of the Walt Disney Studio, and all these guys came out from the West Coast and they brought like the work reels of the new, their upcoming movie Robin Hood. And they showed, it was the first time I saw rough animation, you know, animation that wasn't colored. It was just the pencil drawings. So it's sort of like raw thought on paper. And I was just so charmed by that. I was like, wow, you know, I want to do that. You know, people draw and the characters come to life and they run around on the screen. And like, what a great thing, you know. And so I really kind of like, you know, focused on that I wanted to do that. And, you know, in tying in with the computer stuff, you know, I kind of saw the digital revolution rising in the East, you know, and kind of watched it evolve. Because when I was working on my first jobs in New York, I knew that there were people in Westbury, Long Island, and at the University of Montreal, and at the University of Toronto, and University of Waterloo, working on these computers, and they were trying to create computers that could do drawings, which seemed, it was around 1976. Which seemed very strange to me, like, you know, like, why would you do that? And then very slowly you saw the different films. You know, you saw Luxo Jr. of John Lasseter's and Tony DiPeltri of Philippe Bergeron, and then finally Toy Story.
Well, the reason I asked the question is because since you wanted to be in this business since you were essentially a child, as I have wanted to be in the business I'm in since I was a child, I often ask myself, looking around at how technology has changed and how it's changed my profession, would I want to get into it if I were a child again today? So I'm asking that question to you.
That's a very good question, yeah, because the business has changed in a way that I couldn't foresee, you know, which is that, you know, when I got in the business, you know, we all looked up to these old, you know, white-haired gods, you know, like Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnston, who did Thumper and Bambi and did Captain Hook in Peter Pan, and we wanted to be like them. We wanted to be like those old guys, you know. And now that I'm an old guy with white hair, you know, it's like everybody wants to be Seth MacFarlane and do Family Guy and you know, or Adventure Time. So it's kind of like some of the prior, you know, like the lasting kind of business where you spent, you know, your entire life doing one thing, like just animating on features, it isn't relevant anymore. Like the new sort of career is what they call CG generalists, where you have people who are, they'll work on a traditional animated film, then they'll work on a visual effects film like Spider-Man or The Avengers, then they'll work on a game. You know, and that's become more the norm.
Wow. Now, I mentioned in the introduction that you're also featured in a PBS bio on Walt Disney that airs on September 14th. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. When I wrote my first book, Drawing the Line, you know, a lot of the people who remember the big Disney strike of 1941 were still alive. So I had a chance to basically, you know, interview them and speak to them and get a lot of their testimony, which, you know, the studio always sort of downplayed the labor situation. You know, it was always like, well, you know, Walt had a wonderful family, and then a couple of Reds came and tried to spoil the fun. Then World War II happened. You know, and you're like, wait a minute. You know, the people who lived through that strike, it was like one of the biggest things in their lives. It changed a lot of careers and all. So I'm sort of de facto now the authority on the strike because all those people, you know, have now passed. And I think there's only one living striker left now, an animator, Don Lusk, who's 101. And Tyrus Wong, the art director of Bambi, is 105. And I think that's about it, you know. So when they wanted to do this 4-hour documentary about Walt Disney, you know, instead of just doing a puff piece for the company, they really wanted to get into the man's character and what he went through and the ups and downs of his career. And the strike was a very traumatic period in his lifetime, you know, because right at the time the strike was happening, you know, the war was getting closer and overseas markets were cut off. Walt had just turned 40 years old and his mother died. So he was going through all this, you know, he was processing all these things in his life, and suddenly here's all the workers, you know, all his cartoonists, you know, demanding time and a half and the weekend off, you know.
One last question. We've got about 30 seconds to go, so I'll just put this to you, and that is, you've been there, done that, and seen it all. Are there things today still that wow you in animation?
Oh yeah. I mean, the integration of live action characters with animated characters now has become so seamless. You know, a thing like Guardians of the Galaxy, you know, the raccoon, you know, and the little tree guy and stuff. You know, they're done with the same principles that do Bugs Bunny and Bart Simpson. And I'm very interested in VR and virtual reality, to see how, you know, we're going to be creating worlds within worlds, and you sort of like we would be experiencing animation in a surrounding kind of sense. It'll be interesting to see how that goes.
The book is called Moving Innovation, A History of Computer Animation, written by Tom Seto. Tom, thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Thank you very much.
Animator Tom Seto, author of Moving Innovation, A History of Computer Animation. Again, you can find his website at tomseto.com, and you can also go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0314, and you'll find links to the site and also links to amazon.com, where you can order his books directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
Judge Roger Bartow of Waterloo, New York Village Court was convicted in August of staging a fake assault on himself to convince doctors to prescribe him pain medication. Officers arrived at the scene and found Bartow lying on the ground with a shattered porcelain toilet tank lid nearby from, as he said, being smacked on the head by a mugger. However, doctors found an apparent flaw in Bartow's ruse. He had forgotten to actually hurt himself during the attack, as medical personnel had found no mark, cut, or bruise anywhere on him. So, why? Oh, why? When looking to get pain medication for injuries, would an actual judge fail to inflict even the most minor of injuries on himself to help facilitate his plan? Well, one reason, and one reason only: he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0314. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0314. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I'm your announcer, your name here. Oh, no, I'm sorry. This is Ben Patrick Johnson. What am I being paid for this? What? You're flipping kidding me. Okay, that's it. Turn off the microphone.